So reasoning and problem solving. A lot of variability in the environment. You have to deal with lots of different situations. We use heuristics, if you will, shortcuts for the problem solving. Now, heuristics are great. They're fast, a little easier computationally, but they're not always right. So it's a trade-off. How often are you willing to sacrifice being wrong for being able to be fast? Hey, maybe it actually is only the head and one paw of a tiger behind the tree. Maybe you could go over and score yourself some, you know, dead tiger food. Dead tiger is as food there. But if you go, oh, no, there's a whole rest of the tiger back there behind the tree that I don't see, and you run away, you've missed out on it. But odds are most of the time, you're right. Sometimes you could be wrong. Algorithms, on the other hand, algorithms are going to guarantee a correct answer. Think of them as a logic set, right? If you've got a whole bunch of parameters that feed into the logic set, you can always work your way through to a correct answer there. The problem with an algorithm is it's computationally what we call expensive. It's time-consuming, involves a lot of neural processing, or using a silicon-based computer, a lot of computer processing there. It's more difficult to do. But the plus side is you should get the correct answer running the algorithm. All other things being equal, assuming that you've got all the data going into the algorithm to begin with. But it's slower. If you will, heuristics are like your gut feeling. Sometimes your gut feeling is right. Hopefully, most of the time it is. The more experience you've had with the situation, the more likely you are, for, if you will, your gut to be telling you the right thing. But sometimes you will be wrong. One of the things that can occur with this are what are called representational fallacies. A variety of them here. Let me give you an example. Conjunction fallacy. Your textbook talks about this as well. So the conjunction fallacy. For event one and event two, so for two events to both be true, event one has to occur first and is therefore more likely. Okay, so here's an example. Again, taken straight out of your text. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice and also participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. Which of the following statements about Linda is more probable? One, she is a bank teller. Two, she is a bank teller who is active in the feminist movement. Most people, when given this question with no prior background on it, go, two, she's a bank teller who is active in the feminist movement. Thank you for playing. Actually, the more probable answer here is that one is correct. She's a bank teller. Look at it this way. For her to be a bank teller who is active in the feminist movement, she first has to be a bank teller. So from the conjunction fallacy, for event one and two to both be true, event one has to occur first. That makes event one more likely. It's possible that she is, in fact, a bank teller who is also still active in the feminist movement. But we don't know that for sure. What we can say is what's more likely? Well, she's a bank teller. Two, she's a bank teller who... She's a bank teller. People get this wrong most of the time. I mean, if you're trained in logical reasoning, then you go, ah, one. But give it to just your average person, and it's like, two, why? Well, because two seems representative of the real world. Right from this information you're given here about what she was doing, philosophy, and involved in social justice, and all of this, it seems pretty likely, based on you probably know people that there are somewhere, you know, like that, or heard of people that are like that, know what they're going to do. It makes sense. Based upon past experiences, you jump ahead. It's a heuristic. Algorithmically, you'd be incorrect. But from the sort of heuristic perspective, you're right. And again, this goes back to showing that our brains evolve to solve real-world problems, not abstract logic problems. Our brains are very, very applied systems. They have to be. Here's another one, gambler's fallacy. The idea of the gambler's fallacy is a run of bad luck must eventually be replaced with good luck. I know, I've been losing, but my horse is going to come in, or the cards are going to favor me, or red 23 is eventually going to come up. You poor misguided fool. Here's another one. The house always wins. Ever heard that one? Yeah. Look at it this way. Simple way to show this. Coin toss. Which is more likely? Heads, 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 tails, 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 or heads, tails, tails, heads, heads, tail. Yeah, they're both equally likely. If you know something about probabilities, they're both equally likely. They are each an equally likely probability. But from the real world, which of these two seems, you know, weird? Possibly even a little creepy. The first one, heads, 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 tails, tails, tails. Why? Because, you know, if you just screw around with a coin and flip it occasionally, you don't tend to see the same, you know, head, 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 show up, tail, tail, tail. It could. Ever seen the movie, or actually the play, it started as a play, but turned into a movie, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead? No? Yeah, before your time. So. Anyways, great, this has something to do with two characters from Hamlet. Hamlet, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, bit players, did a a play sort of based around them. And it opens with one of the two of them just like tossing this coin and having this debate. It's like, you know, I've gotten 379 heads in a row. Don't you think that's unusual? And, you know, going on with that. It's like, well, it's pretty unusual, but I mean, it's within the realm of possibility. Yes, I know, but... And it goes with this, right? That's weird. Okay? If you follow an algorithmic interpretation, which means knowing something about probabilistic theory, yeah, you say, neither is more likely. But the representation heuristic says, yeah, the second one is more of what you get. The second one looks more random. If you had heads, 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 tails, 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 you start to worry, whoa, is something being rigged? Is it fixed? Not necessarily. The real world seems to be random to us. Stuff just happens sometimes. Coin tosses should be random. Patterns. And I mean, this is what we do. We look for patterns, right? Patterns suggest a cause. Okay? So heads, 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 tails, tails, tails. That could just be random chance. But it doesn't look random. So we say, oh, you know, the person tossing the coin, they've sleight of hand, they're doing something, they're rigging it somehow. It's a rigged game. It's a con. Maybe, but may not be. So the probability of something occurring is going to often depend on something else having happened first. The problem with that is there's ambiguity as to whether or not or how often or when that first thing would have happened as well. So we've got ambiguity in both cases now. Now, there's actually an algorithm that can be used to solve this called Bayes' theorem. So it's a particular statistical process that's used to calculate the probabilities of a later event being true given the probability of one or more earlier events having occurred as well. Most people never encounter Bayes' theorem unless you specifically get into statistics or have a particular reason for needing this, or if you decide to become a card shark or something like that, and, you know, take the evidence-driven approach to playing poker or whatnot. Most people do not solve problems according to Bayes' theorem. And in fact, the fact that they don't demonstrates what's called the base rate neglect. And this is the failure to take prior probabilities into account. People tend to focus just on the current situation. They don't look at the things that have been occurring before this. Now, the very interesting thing with this, though, is if we talk about this in terms of probabilities, people suck at this. They do really badly. But if we translate this into frequencies, so not probabilities, but frequencies, people still don't do great, but they get better at it. So how frequently would event one occur, do you think? And then how frequently event two? And so if event three is based on events one and two, I mean, how often has that occurred to you? How often is... I've never actually had that happen to me. So... pretty low frequency, right? Yeah. So would you put money on it? No. But if you're asked, what's the probability of event three occurring given events one and events two? People have a hell of a time with that. Oh, I guess that could happen. Sure. 20%. You have to sort of think about it and say, okay, this would have to happen first. Yeah, got that. That ever happened? Yeah, it's happened. And then it would have to be followed by this other thing. Okay, does that happen? Well, you know, maybe once or so. Okay. And then the third thing would have to, is dependent upon the other. It's like, yeah. People are better at that. Interesting. And, I mean, if you think about it, this idea of frequency versus, say, single case probabilities, again, think about the real world. How do we process stuff? Well, frequencies of occurrences. We don't tend to think about stuff in abstract probabilities. It's like, how does this affect me? Right? I mean, go back to the selfish gene theory. It's what's going to happen with me? What have I experienced? Past experience, right? Past experience to predict future events. Well, what have I experienced? Or what has somebody I know experienced? Now, of course, we can get into some very interesting biases there, right? Right? Because, you know, who do you surround yourself with? Probably people that think and act and do things sort of similar to you. So we've got a certain bias. In fact, actually, anybody use Facebook? Yeah? A few people? Okay. People don't want to admit it. Fine. Use Facebook. Okay. Interestingly, you got to check that. If you notice, you'll see Facebook's got a little thing where it will, not everyone you know, not everyone's feeds are going to pop up all the time on your Facebook feed. The links you click, the things you read, the stuff that you open, Facebook tracks that. And it tries to make a better user experience for you. And after some background experience, it'll start preferentially pulling things in that it thinks you want. Which may not be what you're actually, may not be everything. You may not be getting everything for. Now, I mean, if you've got a relatively small friend list, this probably doesn't make a huge difference. But if you've got a larger friend list, you may not be getting this. If you've got someone who's involved in, say, grassroots activism, and is only clicking on stuff that other people they know, they maybe have some people that are involved in grassroots activism and some people that are not. But if they're primarily, because of their interests, clicking on the links coming from their list of friends who are involved in grassroots activism, after a while, Facebook's going to start routing those to the top of your page. Okay, most important, right? If you don't have it just set on most recent, you have it set on whatever the other functions are, right? It'll try to tell you what it thinks you want to see, which gives you a bias. So after a while, it's like, wow, so many people out there are grassroots activists. I only see stuff about grassroots activism. Power to the people. No. That, in fact, may not be representative. So we get some very interesting things with respect to frequencies. Okay? All right. Anyways, representational problems, if you will, these may be very much like the visual illusions. They're not actually flaws, perhaps, in the evolved systems, but adaptations to operate within a real particular environment. So, I mean, again, if most of the time you spend dealing with people that are grassroots activists, that's what's probably most important to you. Now, should you know about the other stuff? Probably yes. Because if you find out that, you know, only 3% of the population gives a damn about grassroots activism, the other 97% actually hates you, you probably should know that. But if that's who you're most surrounded with, again, think about this. If you're in a tribal structure, 150, 200 people tops, what's happening there? Well, that's probably what's most immediately relevant to you. Close network of friends, of people that are kinship, other people that are in the group. That's what's probably most relevant. Not what's happening three tribes over. But that might be very important. We tend to focus on the local because it's most relevant. Cosmides and Tooby have argued, in fact, that the human brain is very good at dealing with frequencies, so repeatedly occurring events, but not single case probabilities, one-off. You could have a tribe, three tribes over, that suddenly decided, hey, we're going to invade you. If they never invaded you before, we've been at peace with this other tribe for generations. Why would they invade us now? I don't know. Whatever reason, they just do. Whoa, didn't see that one coming. Nope, probably not. So, frequency-based decisions. We can see this, in fact, in things like optimal foraging theory. So how should animals, including humans, partition their limited amount of time to gain a maximum of a required resource. You don't want to think about this in terms of foraging, think about this in terms of study. You're taking 5 courses during a term. Which courses are most important to you in your degree? How do you partition your limited amount of time for studying? Do you do everything strictly equally? Do you say, well, you know, I'm not as good in this course as I need to be. I better put more time into that. I just already seem to be pretty good at this course. I can do less there. Oh, this one's really important for my degree. It's what people are going to look at when I apply to grad school or speech path or whatever it is. I need to focus more on that. This option, basket weaving. Do we even teach basket weaving? I don't know. that's not that important. No one's really going to pay attention to that. I can let that go. How do we do that? Okay. So if you don't want to think about it as where shall I go find food right now, think about how are you getting your grades. Comes down to the issue of choice. What do you choose? Behavioral choice is learned by making repeated choices. So you preferentially then shift your behavior towards those that provide more benefits. In learning psychology, we talk about this as Herrnstein's matching law. Eventually, the rate of responding, all other things being equal, will, we say, match the relative rate of reinforcement. So frequency then comes down to being based upon reward. If I do this and I get a reward, will I do it more? Yes. If I do this and I do not get rewarded, will I do it less? Yes. Law of effect. Now, why are single case probabilities hard? Because they require particular reference classes to be useful. You can't generalize particularly easily from this. You need to have a lot of very specific information. You often hear things like, for example, the odds of winning the current lottery are less than the odds of being struck by lightning. What the hell does that mean? I mean, people say it because, like, you're not going to win. But, I mean, honestly, I could make this such that those seem like pretty damn, you know, it could be pretty good odds, right? If you're standing on top of a metal transmission tower in the prairies in a thunderstorm, wrapped in copper wire, waving a golf club, you know, a putter, in the air, your odds of being fried by a lightning strike are pretty damn good. If you're in a salt mine, 1.5 kilometers underground, the odds of you being smacked by lightning, I don't care what, like, level of storm it is, pretty low. When should you play the lottery? See, I mean, people make these statements, but in terms of the probabilities, they're not giving you a probability. They're doing it based on frequency, right? How many people do you know that have been smacked by lightning? I mean, occasionally you get somebody that goes, I know somebody. But, I mean, most people are like, oh, yeah, I was almost hit that time. Really? Well, maybe. I mean, I could have been. I was out in a storm. Yeah, okay. A tree was hit over there. This football field away. But it was close. Okay. Right? So we take this frequency stuff and we treat it as probability. Now, what you should be getting from this is we're not especially good at using, you know, former rules of logic here. For example, people think scientists are weird. I mean, we may be. Let's not rule that. Let's take that, put it aside as a hypothesis. We might be. But in science, a theory can only be disproven. Technically, we can never prove a theory. That just seems weird to people. Scientists that get called as expert testimony in court cases has a hell of a time with this. Lawyers that are not experienced in trying to use expert testimony from scientists in a court case often get their butt handed to them by the jury because another problem with lawyers, you know, is that, you know, did this happen? Can you say that this DNA actually came from the suspect? Well, I mean, it's almost impossible that it didn't. Can you categorically say that it did? Well, categorically? No, I mean, no. There's always a margin of error. Look, I want to talk to you about confidence levels, okay? So the confidence level, no. Can you just, yes or no? Can you say this DNA came from the suspect? The poor scientist is going, well, No, thank. But I'd like to. No, no further questions. Epic fail. Okay. Seems like such a great idea to bring an expert in. People don't get science. Why? Because it's a really particular way of approaching problems. Right? People say, oh, children are just children. All children are scientists. No, they're not. Bullshit. All children are empiricists. What happens when I stick the fork in the light socket? Okay. What happens if I put a marshmallow in the microwave? What happens if I feed the dog all of my beans? A very farty dog. Okay. Whatever. Flatulent hound. Okay. What happens if I... with my daughter, what happens if I start feeding my little brother ice cream? Oh, look, he crawls towards me much more rapidly. I discovered last night as my 4-year-old daughter is like hysterically happy, like shoveling ice cream into my 11-month-old son. It's like, look, he'll follow me! And it's like, yeah, he's chasing the spoon. It's like, wonderful. Conditioning, just what I need. Okay, so all kids are empiricists, but they're not scientists because they don't put the controls in. Right? There is a difference. People are empiricists. They are not scientists. Scientific empiricism is a little bit different. But that little bit is what's really important in determining causality, cause and effect. And that's what science tries to do. It's a particular way of thinking. For most people, it is not, and I hate to use the word natural, but I'm going to, for most people, it is not a natural way of thinking. You have to be trained. You have to be exposed to it. And unfortunately, in psychology here, I think the best way of being exposed to scientific method is to actually get into a lab and do it. We tragically have pretty much no labs in this department, which is very unfortunate. And that's regrettable, but, I mean, there we are. So, we're much better at conditional reasoning here. Give an example, classic now. Johnson, Laird, and Wason about the it's called the Wason selection task. So it works on a logical rule. You can use different logical rules with this, but let's look at the if P then Q logical rule. So if event P, then and only then Q will be true. So here's what they set up. The beauty of the Wason selection task is it's really easy to administer. It's a little stack of cards, and you can do it different ways. But in this case here, what Johnson, Laird, and Wason did in 1970 was they had cards, and an individual card would have a vowel or a consonant on one side, and then a number on the back, an odd or an even number. And they said, okay, here's the rule. A card that has a vowel on one side has an even number on the back. Then they went and laid down some cards on the table, said, which card or cards do you have to turn over to test the rule? And actually what this is, what's the minimum number of cards? So it's like, I turn them all over. It's like, well, okay, yes, you could do that, fine. What's the minimum number you have to turn over to test the rule? Oh. Example. So E, K, 4, and 3. Which cards do you flip? Those two. You have to flip those. How do people do on this? Pretty badly. Only about 4% of respondents figure out that you need to just hit E and 3. Almost half go for E and 4. About 33% go for just E. And some of them, it's just like, E4 and 3? It's tough. So, what about, nobody's going for K, right? Well, think about it. You know, a vowel, card with a vowel has got an even number on the back. Well, K is a consonant, so we don't know anything about that. Why not 4? Vowel, card with a vowel has an even number on the back. So, if you flip 4 over and there's a consonant, oh, wait, that doesn't help you. Because you know what? hey, maybe the rule allows you to have a consonant with an even number on the back as well. All we know is it's got to be a vowel. If you flip over the E and there's an odd number, problem. Rule's been violated. If you flip the 3 over and there's a vowel, violation. Okay? This is tough for people. This has been replicated numerous times. People generally do badly at this. Griggs and Cox reworked this, 1982. They said, let's consider it this way. If a person is drinking alcohol, they must be over 19 years of age. So they're doing this in a place where you had to be 19 or over drinking. So they said, here's a rule. Then they told their subjects, imagine that you're a bouncer or a police officer checking for underage drinkers in this establishment. Okay, and your job is to find underage drinkers and stop them from drinking. Use cards. Here it is. You've got someone drinking Coke, someone drinking beer, someone who's 16, someone who's 19. Who do you have to check? Think about this. Imagine you're the police officer. Who do you check? The beer drinker and the 16-year-old. Most people get this right really easily. Okay? If they're drinking Coke, it doesn't matter how old they are. You can be 16, you can be 90. Yeah. If you're 19, again, if you're 19, you're legal to drink whatever you want. So it doesn't matter. You gotta check the 16-year-old. I mean, the 16-year-old may be drinking Coke, that's fine. But if they're drinking beer, then you got a trouble. You got a problem. The person who's drinking beer, well, you gotta check them because they want to make sure they're over 19. 19 or over. If they're under 19, you got a problem. Okay? Now, when Griggs and Cox, as I said, did this, they found most people had no real trouble doing it. It made sense. This has incidentally been replicated in other cultures. To take part in this, to take part in a tribal council as an adult male, you must have done this thing in the past, right? Killed a lion with, I don't know, a rock, whatever. Okay, some sort of locally relevant custom practice. And you say, okay, so who do you have to check? Who's in council? Who do you have to check? Right? Who's allowed to vote on council? Okay. So you can do this in other ways, and it's been found cross-culturally. You know, this isn't something unique to people that grow up in areas where the legal age of drinking is 19. Okay? This seems to work. You put it into a social framework, and it works. Now, Cosmides took this and said, right, this seems to be evidence that we've evolved a cheat detection system, possibly a cognitive module, right, specifically designed for dealing with issues of social exchange where someone may be trying to cheat you. So this goes back to reciprocity. Okay, so reciprocal arrangements. I do something for you now, you will reciprocate in the future. Now, if you don't, if the person cheats you, then there's a problem. Now, Cosmides argues that because humans are social, they're the social species, then by necessity, with Machiavellian intelligence, hey, if you can get away with doing something for nothing, why wouldn't you? I mean, serious, because you're not a nice person. Yeah, big deal. Think of it from an evolutionary perspective. Right? Self-degenerate. If Safeway undercharges you by $10 for your order, do you go back? Oh, I owe you $10 more. If your friend, you know, undercharges you for 10, you pick up groceries for them and they undercharge $10, yeah, you probably tell them. Why? Because maybe you, or your roommate, or your housemate, or something. Because you probably swap off shopping duties, and, you know, if someone's consistently skimming, this whole thing, you know, you're going to get into problems. But, you know, the large, faceless, you know, conglomerate, Safeway, Walmart, whatever, Canadian Tire, it's like, ah, $10, ah, they won't have any idea who I am. It's not like they're going to find me. Does it make you a bad person? Yes. No. Maybe. It's a moral state. I don't know. Okay? But it's probably in human nature to do this. So, Cosmai says, though, in personal relationships, because you could get cheated, you would expect that we should have some sort of system specifically designed to allow us to detect social cheating. And Cosmai says, this is why the beer or Coke drinking is so easy for people to do, whereas the waste and selection task with a very abstract letters and numbers system is so hard. It says, once you turn this into something that is socially relevant, then people go, oh, yeah. Well, obviously, and well, actually, they're not even going, oh, yeah. Cosmides actually says, as soon as you turn it into something relevant, boom, it activates this particular module. Your module just kicks in, and you solve the problem. Fast. Because those of our ancestors who didn't got cheated and ultimately probably didn't pass on the genes. Okay? So she calls a social contract infringement. Now, as it turns out, Pollard and Evans tried something like this. They tried replicating the Beer-Coke study, but they omitted the police, if you will, the police cover story. They just said, if you're 19, you can drink beer. Who do you have to check? Who's legal here? People had more trouble. They still did not bad on it, but they had more trouble with it. It was harder for them to do. If they didn't say, now imagine you are a police officer. Right, that's kind of different. I mean, you know, I brew beer at home. Home brew, beer, wine. My son's 6. I mean, you want some beer? There. He doesn't actually like it at this point. That's fine. But am I going to get bent out of shape? I mean, he's learning how to make beer. He's either going to be a really, really popular teenager or, well, you know. Am I that concerned? No. You know, when he's a bit older, you know, are my kids going to be allowed to drink beer or wine with their? Yes. Are they able to do this out in a restaurant? No. Can they do it at home? Yes. Am I going to card my kids, you know, when we're having a barbecue in the backyard when they're like teenagers about this? No. If their friends come over, then we get into a different issue, right? Then I may have to play police officer, right? Police officer dad. Oh, no, did you bring a note from your parents saying it's okay for you to have a, you know, half a glass of wine or something here, you're 14? You give people the cover story, it's like, oh, yeah, it's easy. Okay. Now, when we're looking at this, from this perspective, this starts to look like Cosmide's interpretation here of a cheat detection module that is designed specifically for social contract infringement. Seems pretty good. It's like, aha, there we go, cognitive module. Not everyone agrees, though. Oakesford and Chatter, for example, 94, said, okay, look, the two tasks that you've done here, the waste and selection task and the beer Coke drinking task, they're actually dealing with what they call entirely different domains of processing. So one here is an abstract task. In abstract tasks, you need to determine the truth or falsehood of a rule. This is what we technically call an indicative task. So the waste and selection task, the if P then Q, if it's a vowel, it'll have an even number on the back. This is what we call an abstract task. It's testing for a particular rule, so it's indicative. The underage drinking task, though, this isn't concerned about the truth, but with these things called obligations. It's a deontic task, right? Can a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old be drinking beer? Yeah. Should they? That's a different issue. Speed limit of 110 on the highway. If it's a rule, if it's an indicative task or rule, you wouldn't be able to get over 110. The speed limit is 110. 110, stuck there. It's going to take some people a little bit longer to get to Calgary. No, the speed limit isn't indicative. It's the on take. It's like, you shouldn't go over 110. Yeah, but I can. But you shouldn't. Why not? Because if you get caught, you're going to get a ticket. Oh, yeah. Okay. Different issue. What Oakeshott and Chatter are saying is that most of what we deal with in our social existence are not abstract indicative tasks. They're not these abstract rules. They are deontic things. These are dealing with obligations. And as such, you know, it may not be that we've got a social infringement cognitive module here, a cheat detection module. Just maybe these are actually dealing with different things. Okay, there could be a totally different way of processing. So they're arguing that you don't have to postulate a specific cognitive module designed for social infringement that only does that. They suggest that somehow our brain has got the ability to either process abstract rules, abstract tasks, which we're perhaps not as good at, as we discussed earlier, and the ability to process deontic tasks, which, due to frequency issues, issues of frequency, we are better at. So we don't have to specifically evolve a cognitive module to do this. So, in indicative tasks, we reject rules based on finding contradictory evidence. So, all swans are white. Now go test. White swan, white swan, white swan, white swan, white swan. Not until you get down to Australia that you're going to find black swans. If you stop at some point before you get to Australia, is a long ways away. I'm just going to stop here. I've looked at 6,000 swans in North America. They're all white. I'm done. Oops. Should have gone a little bit further. Deontic tasks. In deontic tasks, you can't prove the rule as being true or false. Right? Under 19, not allowed to drink. But if you find someone that's breaking the rule, it doesn't make the rule false. The law still says if you're under 19, you can't drink. Yeah, but I am. Well, you're breaking the law. If the very fact that you can drink and you're under 19, if it was an abstract task, it's like, whoa, okay, I guess that rule goes away. Doesn't work that way. Okay, so different systems. So their argument is that Cosmide's incorrect here. These are not actually the same test. So that by arguing that they are, there's a mistake here. In other words, it's a confound. It's a confound in Cosmide's reasoning. Now keep in mind, they're also saying, well, it's possible that we've got a social cognitive module that tests for cheat detection. What Oxford and Chatter are saying is just we can't tell from this particular test. So maybe there is one. But this doesn't prove it. This doesn't demonstrate it. Okay. So, if you're presented with an indicative task, the argument here is you should act to reduce the levels of uncertainty about the world. The rarity assumption, what's called the rarity assumption, comes in. In most cases, finding out that something is actually true is more informative than finding out that something is not true. I talked about how science seems a bit weird to most people. You'd rather, well, we only disprove stuff. Wouldn't it just be easier to find out if something is true or not? Who actually wrote in crayon on the wall? Which of your kids? Maybe it's easier to find out who didn't do it. I'm going to rule out my 11-month-old because he's not tall enough. Sure, he can stand now, but he can't reach it. Okay. But both my 4-year-old daughter and my 6-year-old son both can reach the area. I've at least ruled one out. But can I figure out which one is actually it? What's the truth? I don't know. Maybe I need to do something else. Look for, and get all CSI, look for crayon smear on their hands. You may not know about crayon transfer. Yeah. Spritz the hands with something, find it. Whatever. In the waste and selection task, you're more likely to choose the cue card than the not cue card. Because that seems to be finding something that's true. Usually, getting what we call positive information is more useful than negative information. Is it more useful to know if someone's lying or that they're not lying? They're not lying. We talked about sort of deception back with mate choice, right? You can either outright lie, or you can just kind of withhold some of the truth. Which is easier to find? Well, the outright lie is probably easier to catch. If you can catch somebody in that, it's like, wait, I've actually got evidence that what you've just said is not true. Whereas if you've just withholded some sort of information, like, ugh, what do I do with that? They haven't said something that's an outright lie, but they haven't given me a, got to get that information to deal with it. If you don't have the data, you can't figure it out. Usually having positive evidence of something is much more useful than negative, than a lack of evidence. With deontic tasks, these require you to take a particular perspective towards a rule, like enforcing it. I don't particularly, I'm putting this on a podcast, I'm sure, like, that's when Child Services showed up and took my kids. I don't have any particular concerns with, you know, my kids when they're older drinking a bit of alcohol under adult parental me supervision. Do I think something magical happens when you hit 18 and you're allowed to drink legally in Alberta? No. I know people that are in their 50s that shouldn't drink. They're just idiots. All right? Not mentioning any names, Jim. But, am I listening, Jim? Are you listening? No. Anyways, I've taken a position. It doesn't make the rule true or false. You just, am I going to enforce it or not? In this case, rarity assumptions don't apply. You can't use that to decide. Instead, you know, based on you're taking a position towards something, you know, in this case here, so the beer, or, you know, the police cover story with the beer or the Coke, the high value is being placed on catching the violators. Why? Because that's the law. Social infringement based upon the law. All cultures impose rules and regulations on the members of that culture, be it a tribal group, a religious group, a country, a subculture, right? Goth kids are suddenly wearing bright colors and being happy. It's like, whoa, you violated the goth rule. I just thought I'd like some color in my hair. Black is just so, you know, it's cold. Why? Well, because, that's actually a good question, you know. Well, let's think about that. Okay, so, I mean, different here. Now, if you do it that way, then your rational choice in the situation is to select P and the not Q options, which is what you should do in the beer Coke situation, what people do, in fact. It gets easier. Which theory is correct? So who's right? Who's right here? This idea that there's differences between indicative and deontic tasks is sometimes wrapped up, tied up in a bow, and called the information gain theory. It's just saying that our brains have evolved in a way that are designed to gain as much information as we can that is going to be useful in guiding our behavioral judgments. Given that, and given the way scientific theory works, we often say, well, good scientific theories are those that explain a wider range of phenomena. So we've got two ideas here. Our information gain theory, which can be applied to a whole range of stuff, or the social contract infringement module theory. It says there's a specific module that's evolved to do this thing. If we just look at it from a sort of scientific theory testing approach, the information gain theory seems stronger. It can apply a wider range of possible events than Cosamide's social infringement cognitive module, imperative cognitive module approach here. Now, that being said, while we tend to say that scientific theories that can explain a wider range of phenomena are better, doesn't mean they're necessarily true, right? We get back to that disproof thing. So it's possible that there is, in fact, a social contract infringement module that in humans has evolved to deal with this specific thing. Part of where this is very hard to analyze is we're humans. There's not a lot of good non-human models that we can use to compare, right? You have chimpanzees, a bunch of beer and some Coke, and those drink all of it. Well, it's a massive party. Double shots of beer and Coke all at the same time, okay? They don't have that kind of rule. Chimpanzee rules are, well, it's kind of like, you know, Jack Sparrow's. Take what you can, give nothing back, right? Slip a little pirates theme in here today. So, if you can, why not? Humans, because of language, and we'll talk about language later on in the course, because of language, we've got what we call rule-governed behavior. This, I keep talking about learning behavioral stuff today because that's sort of the other hat I wear on my big pumpkin-shaped bald head is learning behavior. But when you look at it this way, I mean, you do studies with, say, operant conditioning. Press a lever, get a yummy for a rat. Young kids, like below the age of 2 or 3, you know, they'll show pretty much exactly the same pattern of behavior as rats or pigeons. Okay? They're great. They'll actually do the behavior. They'll optimize. They'll get the reinforcers. Score. They do really well. You have enough time to play with it. They do really well. Older kids or adults, it's just messed up, right? Like on a variable interval schedule, you should just press, you know, not too fast, not too slow. Keep responding. Eventually, you know, you press at sort of a moderate rate, you'll get most of the reinforcers available. But you give people tasks like this, adults, and they start saying, it's like, yeah, it took me a long time to figure it out, but I figured out that what it was you'd only reinforce me, you'd only give me the treat, or the coin or the token, whatever it was, after I heard a click coming from, I think, outside in the other room. So that's the signal. It's like, yes, good job, that was it exactly. Just random time. I figured it out. You were trying to make me stand up more, so eventually I would just stand up and push the lever. Yes, good job. People look for rules. It's a psychology experiment. They must be messing with me. Yes, you're right. We really are. No. Sometimes we are, right? We generalize, right? We stereotype. Oh, it's a psychology experiment. You must want to know what I think about my mother. Not really. Don't really care. Not that important. It's just a perception task. This illusion doesn't tell me anything about what you think of your mother. Big deal. Right? People generalize it. Rules. We invent rules. Non-humans don't do this. So it's really tough to model this. Miller has described humans as informivores. He said perhaps instead of describing, you know, as carnivores or herbivores or omnivores, humans should be categorized as informivores. That is, we consume information in the same way that other animals consume food. We need information to be able to survive. In some ways, this is not wrong. We exist in these highly complex social structures. We exist in complicated environments. We have spread out of Africa and populated pretty much all of the environmental niches on our planet. And someday I am hopeful we will move beyond our planet and colonize entirely new environments. That requires information, processing. We are better at it, for better or worse, than any other species. We still get it wrong frequently. Not necessarily as individuals at the local level, but on global scales, we can definitely screw this up. But again, think about this from the evolutionary psychology perspective. It's not surprising that we are messing up things with respect to global warming. The scale is too big. We didn't evolve to deal with these sorts of issues. We evolved to deal with the issues that directly influenced us as individuals and perhaps those people that were closest to us. Trying to conceptualize what is happening half a world away is not something that our brains evolved to deal with, so we're not particularly good at it. doesn't mean that we can't do it, though. By being presented with the information, by giving people access to information, perhaps we can have the correct decisions being made, whatever those mean. All right. Thus endeth the lesson. So, got an exam next class, yeah? Yeah, yeah? If you all said no, it would have been like, oh, okay, my mistake then. Well, I guess we'll just let... too late. So, sample midterm's been up for weeks now. Hopefully I have a chance to go through that. Basically, you know, you get the exam book, and there'll be a question at the top of the page. Blah, blah, blah. You got a space to fill it in. Answer 5 of the 7 questions that are available. If you answer more than 5, I will, you know, grade the first 5 and stop. So, if you grade more than 5, let me know which ones you want me to grade. I'll pick the best ones. You've got to tell me, okay? Your judgment on that one. All I can say with this is don't panic. I mean, the questions are more, you know, general sort of theory. I mean, if you understand the concepts that underlie what we've been talking about, as opposed to memorizing factoids. Damn it, I can't remember. Was it the study where they said beer and coke, or was it like cocaine and heroin? Ah, crap. No, it doesn't. Right? If you understand the underlying concepts, even if you don't remember all the little specifics, you can get most of the way there. Okay, you should be able, if you understand the underlying concepts, if you're focused on those, you should be able to formulate a pretty good answer, even if you don't really remember this, even if I reference something specific. I will not ask you things like, what did Miller, 1997, say? Because that's just bullshit. I don't care. You don't need to memorize that. What I do want you to focus on is the concepts. How does evolutionary psychology, the underlying theory, work? What does it mean? How can you apply it? Where does it go? All right. I mean, I may ask about some particular theories or whatnot, but again, it's sort of a theory level. It's not a little picky experimental detail level. Keep track of your time, all right? You'll have 80 minutes to do the exam, and we'll take sort of a 10-minute break and get back into lecturing, okay? So do keep track of your time there. You should have enough time to do it. Remember, just like with the assignments, they don't have to be giant answers. They're all designed to be answerable. Come up with, I mean, you could write a book on some questions that I can toss at you. I'm not expecting that. There's that. I have your second assignments back, so we'll get those.